Welcome to Spanish Janice. I'm Janice Burt, and today we're diving into conversations that inspire growth, connection, and confidence. You're watching Now Media Television.
Welcome, everybody, to Spanish Janice, where we mix business, leadership, and wellness with all the messy stuff in between. I am your host, Janice Burt. And if you have ever been crushing it on paper, like crushing it, but secretly you feel frozen inside and stuck, overwhelmed, where you procrastinate, maybe scroll through Facebook, maybe you snack a little too much, this episode is for you. My guest today is the one and only, the amazing Britt Frank. She is a trauma therapist and somatic experiencing practitioner who helps high performers like you understand the real mechanics of getting unstuck. She is the author of The Science of Stuck and Align Your Mind. We all need that. And she teaches us practical tools that work even when motivation is just nowhere to be found. So, Britt Frank, bienvenida. Welcome to Spanish Janice.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me on. It is so good to see you.
It is wonderful to see you. I was just thinking about the last time we actually spoke, and I can't believe it's been like a year and a couple months since you came on the One Fear Per Year podcast with me. Now, just to remind everybody, when she came on that podcast, we were talking, well, I'm going to let you tell them, what were you going to do and then what did you do?
Gosh, that seems like a lifetime ago. So when I met you, the fear that I was working on was doing a circus performance live high up in the air in front of a paying audience. And I did in fact do that. So check, nailed it. Ha!
Okay, you can't just leave us with circus performance. Like, we want to know, tell them exactly not only what you did, but the preparation involved in doing what you did.
So I think for high achievers, high performers, type A go-getters, to get out of our heads, we kind of need some extreme hobbies. And I do think that extreme sports is a really good way to get out of an overthinking, ruminating, overanalyzing kind of mind. For me, being on this giant 3-foot-wide metal hoop hanging from the ceiling spinning meant that if I did not fully pay attention to what I was doing and be present, I would get very, very badly injured. So I figured out the only thing that I need to quiet my mind is to be upside down 10 feet in the air and swing. We're good to go.
Good to go. But didn't you also tell me that prior to that, you had fallen on your head? Is this true?
I forgot I told you that. Yes. So I did have a circus accident when I was a kid and fell on my head and was terrified of heights ever since. And so the fear I wanted to conquer was, as an adult, can I pick back up this art form that I had loved, this sport that I had loved so much? And I'm here to tell you the fear of heights does not go away, but the being able to manage your way through it is what got me through that show, to that show, all of the things. Because there was not an absence of fear. It was more like a stubborn determination to do the thing I wanted to do.
Well, stubborn determination and just pure courage, which is taking that leap of faith, doing the thing first without knowing what the result is going to be. So hats off to you. I'm a huge Britt Frank fan. So before we go into the science, which I know you are very much about the science of it, which people really love and appreciate. But what is the kind of real life version of you that maybe people don't see, like behind the scenes, Britt Frank version of you?
This is where I think that our talk about authenticity can become very problematic. because how many personalities do each of us have? I mean, I'm speaking to you right now and I have on a suit and I have my glasses on and I'm speaking in full sentences. I'm not being fake, but in 49 minutes, I'm going to be splayed out on my couch with snacks and probably incomprehensible, right? So I think it's important to know for every forward-facing person that we all see, there's a behind-the-scenes version. And the behind-the-scenes versions are not always nice and clean and pretty. And I'll tell you, I actually got a back injury after that show. And so I'm like in a dealing with back surgery, can't really walk, I'm not very mobile thing. And so when I click off here, it's going to be like, oh my gosh, it hurts. And how come bodies can feel so bad? And I think it's important to give ourselves permission, not only to let all of our personalities be there, but to remind yourself, nobody is, quote, authentically one version. We're all 5,000 versions of ourselves. I always tell people, think of, you know, how you present yourself like a closet. Authenticity is not pick one outfit and wear it for the rest of your life. I'm authentically me when I'm happy and when I'm sad and when I'm angry and when I'm stuck and when I'm getting unstuck. And so it can be easy to compare, but we all have a full closet of personalities. It's just different ones come out on different days.
Well, and I just want to thank you for sharing that and being vulnerable, because so many times what we see on LinkedIn or Instagram is not the whole story of what's going on in someone's life. So I feel like it's really important to always remember that. And what brings me back to this work a lot of times is thinking, you know, if I just happen to say something that translates to somebody else as encouragement and hope, and they were in a place of just not wanting to be on planet Earth anymore, then oh my gosh, what more could I ask for? You know, I just open my mouth with all the messy things that can come out of it with the hopes that maybe there's something that somebody will go, you know what, I really needed to hear that today. And I know you are a trauma expert, so you know all about trauma and how that impacts us. What do you want people to understand about trauma, I would say? What are some just basic things that people should know about trauma? And maybe there's some misconceptions about trauma.
So it's really interesting, because when I became a trauma therapist, nobody was talking about trauma. It was not a word that you heard even in therapy circles, let alone on a business leadership wellness podcast. It was just not something that you heard about. Suddenly, in the last 6 or 7 years, it's trauma everywhere. Everything is trauma. Someone was rude to you and now you're traumatized. You were uncomfortable standing in line and now you're triggered. So I think there has been an over-indexing of therapy speak, which as a trauma therapist makes me both happy, yay, we're talking about it, and sad. Well, now that everything is trauma and every rude person is a narcissist and every discomfort of being a human is now a trigger, it sort of lost its meaning. So as a trauma expert, my big thing now is to tell people, I don't care what you call it, what's really true for you. You know, you may not think you have trauma, fine, but you know, how's your relationship with your finances and with food and with your body and with intimacy and with friendships and with meaningful work and with hobbies? If that's not all 10 out of 10, we don't have to call it trauma, but we should probably look at it. So now as a trauma expert, I'm less this is trauma and more what is your experience? What's true for you? And how can we get you up leveling where we can so you can feel better, lead better, act better?
And do you feel like things from our childhood and adolescence, the things that might be considered trauma or just, you know, very uncomfortable events that happened back then or words that were spoken to us, do most people bring those things into their adult life with them? If they're not aware, do we kind of bring that into adulthood, and then like little Janice is showing up sometimes in like adult Janice?
Well, I love little Janice, you know. And I do think as we grow, and there's nothing particularly mystical or therapy speak about this. We have every experience that we've ever lived through is encoded in our brains. And so it's not like your childhood disappears when you become an adult. All of those memories and feelings, they all get stored. And if you want to talk about trauma, trauma is simply your storage container is disorganized. That's a really, really reductive way to put it. But trauma doesn't mean you were beaten as a child. It doesn't have to mean you were deployed and you did time in a war-torn country. Trauma is anywhere where an experience wasn't able to be metabolized by your brain. And yeah, that can show up in adulthood as anxiety or fear or procrastination, but not everything has to be brought back to childhood. Now, I love doing inner child work. I love helping high-functioning adults reconnect play and wonder and curiosity. And I join the circus. And what's your version of that? But I also think it's important that we don't need to figure out why we're stuck to get unstuck. So I know for me, I've blacked out most of my childhood. Like, I legitimately, if you asked me, tell me about year five, I'd be, I don't know. So you don't have to go hunting in your past for memories, because what happens is people who had relatively decent childhoods will say, well, I don't have trauma. Nothing bad ever happened to me. I had great parents. Okay, well, life is hard. So I think to say that nothing negative ever happened is a bit of a untrue statement, but okay. But then people who had really bad things happen, they still do the comparison game. Well, yeah, this happened to me, but it's not like it was as bad as those people down the street. So I think the comparison game and feeling like we need to go back in order to solve for stuckness now is just not untrue. But if you're asking, do I think that we all have little inner children parts of us that need to come out and play? Yes, and science backs that up. People who don't play, adults who don't play, are they tend to be more high strung, more stressed out, less physically healthy. And so there's a business case for why creativity and play are really, really important for adults, trauma or no trauma.
Yes, that's why I'm a huge proponent of joining improv or doing something, anything that is fun and different, a little bit unique that pulls you out of your shell, and you get to explore and, as you said, play a little bit more. With that, we will be right back with Britt Frank. Stay with us, everybody.
We'll be right back with more insight, inspiration, and real conversations. This is Spanish Janice on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm Janice Burt, and you're watching Spanish Janice. Let's keep growing together.
We are back. Welcome back to Spanish Janice with Britt Frank. And I had a question, Britt, based on that last little segment that we just filmed about trauma or certain memories being stored in the body. How do we know that we are carrying something from our past with us in our body? Just as a quick example from my own life, I had this experience when I was 16 of entering a speech competition, forgetting my lines, feeling like a total failure and not speaking publicly for 20 years because that event happened. And then when I went back to start public speaking again, about 13 years ago, I would shake, like actually viscerally shake every time, pretty much every time I stood up. So, do you know just what that is in the body and what are some tools to help people release any trauma that might be stored inside?
I had no idea that that happened to you. Oh my God. I mean, that's the perfect example of is that trauma? We're not comparing it to every trauma, but for that version of you in that moment, it was traumatic. And it did show up as a physical symptom later on. So I so appreciate you sharing that. And oh, that sounds terrible. I have stories like that too. So this idea of trauma being stored in the body It's really interesting if you're on social media right now, because there is this very, very heated debate among therapists about, well, it's not stored in the body, it's stored in the brain. And then the brain sends the nerves and makes the body feel things. No, trauma's stored in the brain, trauma's stored in the body. Okay, like our brains are so complex. It is such a wild interconnection of neurons. And then we have environment and genetics and the things that we learn. No one really knows how it works. So am I going to sit here and say trauma is without a doubt stored in the body? And here is the file cabinet in your intestines where you can unearth that memory. No. That said, you experienced it yourself, right? You went to do a thing and your body had a reaction that to your logical brain did not match the experience. Why am I shaking? I'm doing a thing. I'm in a new place. I am a new person. I'm totally different. So what's going on? So what happens is we forget that we walk around the planet in bodies. You know, I used to think I was a floating head. I love thinking and analyzing, and I don't want to have to feel feelings. But often, and it's like metabolizing food. This is how I like to describe trauma in the body. If you eat something and your body doesn't digest it, you're going to have symptoms. And we all know what the symptoms of indigestion look and feel like. Anything in your life that doesn't get metabolized properly, for whatever reason, that can show up as body responses like shaking. It could show up like non-medical reasons for insomnia. And it's tricky, right? Because we have all of these different reasons. When I injured my back, and I didn't totally injure it doing circus, it just sort of like I woke up and my back hurt. And it was like, okay, well, where in my childhood did somebody say something mean and now my back hurts? There's a place for that. And I was bullied as a child, but I also have an L5-S1 disc bulge. And so it's helpful to know that this mind-body thing is an interconnected web with no easy answers. So if you are my client coming to me and saying, why am I shaking before a speech? You know, that thing back then, it was so long ago, it shouldn't bother me. What I would say is, well, it might not logically bother you, but it bothers your body. And fortunately, there are tools and techniques and frameworks that you can use to help your body metabolize experiences. And that's the type of therapy I practice.
And speaking of tools and techniques, so here's the thing that I want to dig a little deeper with you, because I have done a lot of the tools and techniques that I know of. So I'd like to hear some of yours. Some of the ones that come to mind for me are like meditation. I've done some somatic classes, some breath work, yoga, journaling, all the gratitude stuff, the reframing, viewing it a different way. And that being said, it will still pop up on occasion. And I am of the mindset of the lesson for me is to accept the reality of what is happening. So even though I wish I wasn't shaking, I'm coming to the place of acceptance. Like, this is happening now in this moment. And so I am going to accept that it's happening and I'm going to move through it. But tell me some tools that you use in your practice for this type of thing.
Well, I love that you named acceptance, because the only thing that will guaranteed make a nervous reaction worse is thinking this shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't be feeling this. Okay, well, if you shouldn't be feeling a way and you are, now you're fighting with yourself. And your brain does not distinguish, neurologically, your brain does not distinguish you fighting with you or me fighting with you. And if someone's fighting with you, what do brains do? They go, oh, someone's coming at me. Well, we know what to do. We're going to send stress hormones careening through their body so that they're ready for the fight, so that that person stays alive. And so when you're already activated, telling yourself it shouldn't be this way has very real physiological consequences. So we don't want to do that. You can say, wow, I don't like this feeling. And I accept that if you're going to do a big thing, like speak in front of 1,000 people or hang upside down in front of people, your body's going to be nervous about it. And that's normal. Again, I think culturally right now, we want to find the label to diagnose every human experience as something wrong is happening. It is normal and healthy and appropriate and to be expected to feel nervous before doing anything that's big or hard or important. That said, I do have brain hacks, and I love everything you said, yoga and journaling and meditation and gratitude. Those are all wonderful. I have some unhinged practices that I really like. For me, with public speaking, because my body, like in my head, I'm fine. I know my content. I'm very comfortable with how I do things. My body still doesn't know that I'm not about to get eaten by a lion. And so one of my hacks for speaking is to wear the most beautiful but uncomfortable shoes that I can find. This gives me a great excuse to buy beautiful shoes. But when you're wearing uncomfortable shoes, then your brain has something else to focus on besides the rumination of, oh no, what am I going to say? And what are they going to think? Uncomfortable shoes are almost like a chew toy for your brain. So even if you're not a public speaker, if you have to have a hard conversation or you're sitting in a difficult meeting at work, even if you're home on Zoom, put on a pair of really uncomfortable shoes, the kind that make your feet just beg for freedom. And that will give your brain a little distraction. It won't make you feel better, but it will give you just enough room cognitively to show up, suit up, and execute. I love that one. That one's fun.
That is a fun one. And I will say a unique one because I've never heard that before. And in my situation with the shaking, I have found that I don't wear high heels at all because it makes the shaking much worse and more visible. So I will wear the flattest of flat shoes that I can find, or there have been times I've actually taken my shoes off completely so that I could be rooted into the earth just with my feet. And that tends to give a little bit of a calming for that nervous reaction. So anyway, but I love that concept of wearing shoes that are just uncomfortable to take that little bit of an edge off. And I also want to just pivot a little bit to this concept of people pleasing and this fear of rejection, fear of criticism that it seems like is just permeating it through our society, at least the youth. I have two young adult children, and this fear is so deep and intense with what people are going to think about me. What has been your experience with your clients who deal with that? Like, have you seen that a lot? And if so, what are some things that we can do to maybe care less about what people think about us? Or what are your thoughts on that?
It's so tricky because I do think fear of rejection and social isolation, again, is encoded in our human wiring. So I don't think it's anything new. That said, I was the last generation before social media was everywhere and everyone was using it. I think it came out when I was a senior in college, but it was still sort of fringe. I do think now with instant access to everyone everywhere doing amazing things, you know, if I pick up my phone and open Instagram, I'm instantly assaulted with millions of people doing things I couldn't do in my wildest dreams, right? I can't cook, I can't knit or crochet or make a 3D cake out of whatever. There's so many, or the Cirque du Soleil people. I mean, it's not hard if you're doing the comparison game to find people who are doing it better, who, you know, are happier or wealthier or healthier or whatever. So this fear of being excommunicated by the social group if we're not good enough is real. And I do think that we can be a little flippant with younger people about, you shouldn't care what anyone else thinks of you. Well, historically, if your tribe rejected you, you were shunned and you were left to die alone in the wild. And human brains don't update like our cell phones. And so the same operating system that kept you compliant in a group is still running the show inside all of us, except now we have social media to contend with. So rather than you shouldn't care what other people think, it can be really helpful to build a really, and this is for young people, for us, for every age, We need to build a robust life that's not online. We need to know that when we turn off the devices, we're still connected to people and to meaningful activities. Because when our whole existence is online and people don't like us, then what are we left with? But I think it's important to validate that's a both ands. I'm not saying don't use social media. I'm saying when you turn your phone off, are you twitchy because you have no one to talk to and nothing to do and nothing to look at? Great. That's a sign that we need to construct an architecture outside of the social media swirl. And that's doable. That is something that we can solve for.
And not just that, with AI, the rise of AI and robots doing different things. This idea of getting out with actual humans, I think, is going to be more of a thing that we're going to have to push for all of us, and especially the younger generation. We are going to take a quick break and come right back with Britt Frank. Stay with us, everybody.
We'll be right back with more insight, inspiration, and real conversations. This is Spanish Janice on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm Janice Burt, and you're watching Spanish Janice. Let's keep growing together.
We are back on. Welcome back to Spanish Janice. And I really want to get practical now. I'm talking deadlines, employees, clients, family, work, life. So Britt, I want to talk first of all about being a leader. When you see a regulated leader, what do you see? What does that look like?
So the concept of emotional regulation, I first heard in the trauma world. And what emotional regulation does not mean is happy or nice or super calm all the time. A lot of people think, well, a regulated leader is just going to coddle people and tell them nice things and get nothing done. Emotional regulation is not, let's be happy. Emotional regulation for a leader is your brain operating from the front or the back? And here's how you can tell the difference. The front of your brain is where things like logic and reason and the ability to take in information and assess options and manage your emotions, all that stuff is front brain activity. When you're not regulated, the back of your brain lights up. And that's the threat response center, the fear center. And that's when you're in the emotional part of things. That's when you're losing your cool or feeling like you went from a 0 to a 10 without any stops along the way. And one of the most important keys to successful leadership is the ability to keep yourself regulated so that the people that you're leading have someone to look at to set the course, to set the direction, to give them enough of the information that they need to do their jobs. None of which is ideal when your leaders are coming at you from the back of the brain. Now, obviously, we can see back brain leaders everywhere. Having your emotions driving your leadership style is a thing, but if you're looking for the ideal, optimal conditions to manage change in this current landscape, my argument is front brain driven leaders are going to do better, work better, have happier people. And if we want to talk just basic bottom line, regulated leadership is better for revenue generation than emotional back brain stuff.
Now, I love how you explained that. How do you explain, or what is the balance between head, and when I say head, then I'm talking about the front part that you've mentioned, and then heart. So head and heart leadership, how do you think there's a place for the heart in leadership? So not emotional reactivity, but like the heart, you know what I'm talking about. How do you view that?
I think that the heart makes a wonderful board member or consultant, but a terrible CEO. So when we're talking about leading people, yes, I want people in charge that like humans, that want their humans to matter and to feel like they're not just a number in a system. That said, it's really hard to make the type of decisions some leaders have to make while also in your feelings. And it's not an either or. We don't want to be complete robots making decisions, but we also don't want to be so in empathy and in our feelings that we can't make hard calls. So I do think that the best place for the heart-centered leadership is right next to the head, not driving the car, maybe riding shotgun.
Oh, and what if someone is a heart-centered leader? What things can they do to work on this CEO front brain leadership, you know, like using your head kind of leadership? Are there things they can do to jump over a little bit that way?
So I don't know, you know, people who identify as heart-centered leaders, if I were to examine their leadership style, I might argue and say, I actually don't see you as a heart-centered leader. I see you as a leader who recognizes that there are humans that we work with and you have a heart. So being a fully heart-centered leader means it's a binary. You're either head or your heart. I want both. We need to have both. And you'll know you're tipping into one over the other. It's pretty easy if you look. You know, people who are too head-centered, how are your relationships? What would your employees say about you? You know, do you have any empathy whatsoever? Whereas someone who is dominated primarily by the heart might have trouble letting someone go. I've worked with people who say, I can't fire employees because I feel so bad and I love my people and I don't want to have to put anyone out of a job. And I appreciate that. And we have to also manage the demands of heart-centered, head-centered, and at the end of the day, what's the job here? You know, you can be a heart-centered leader if you have all of the funding and all of the power and you set the policy and you make the rules. If you have stakeholders or a board of directors to answer to, it can be tricky. But I'm certainly not advocating for one over the other. The best place to start, to answer your question, is to do a really serious inventory of how's your head stuff? How's your heart stuff? Are they fairly balanced? And if not, we want to then beef up whichever one feels like it's not as robust as it could be.
Such a good answer. I love that. And when we're talking about business owners in their day-to-day activities, and a lot of times there's a lot of stress involved, it's some hustle going on. What's like a 60-second kind of micro reset that people can do when they feel just that burden of stress, you know, almost verge of panic attack kind of things coming on? What's a micro reset?
Oh, I love that question. And this goes back to what you were talking about with the fear of speaking. Sometimes it's acceptance that it's going to feel awful at the top sometimes. If you are a leader, it's going to be at some point an impossible task. So the expectation that we have for excellence is good. The expectation that we have for perfection is going to set us up for burnout and panic attacks and all of those physical symptoms that we don't want. And so we really need to set our expectations at a level that we can hit them. We want to strive for doing a little bit better, but 1% better tomorrow is still better than 0%. But if you shoot for a 50% improvement, you're going to set yourself up for failure. And then that creates a negative feedback loop and that creates a downward spiral. And my new book is actually called Shame Spiral, because when that happens, we feel ashamed, and then people who feel ashamed don't tend to make good choices, and then off and down it goes. And so that's important. The micro reset question, and this is such a good question because it immediately switches your brain from the back to the front, is this. Stop in your tracks for a second. Put this computer down and ask yourself, what are my choices right now? There's a framework I love called the OODA loop, O-O-D-A. The OODA loop came from the military. It came from Colonel John Boyd, and it stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. And fighter pilots use this, apparently. But it's a really good check for any leader or business owner. It's just first observe what's going on, orient, what are my choices, make a decision, what can I grab right now, act, take the feedback from that, and then repeat. And then that becomes a positive feedback loop or an upward spiral.
Oh, I have actually heard of that before, the OODA loop. And I love frameworks like that because really when you're in the middle of something, a stressful situation or whatever, if you can, if you have an acronym that you can easily grab and go like, wait a minute, where am I at? What do I need to do? I think those are, it's so great to have that kind of framework. What would you say is a warning sign of somebody that's just about to hit kind of that real burnout, like way too much stress is happening right now and we need to do something different? What are some warning signs that people could identify before they actually have full-on burnout?
Yeah, and it's important to know burnout is not a motivation problem and it's not a I hate my job problem. People, myself included, who love their work can get burnt out. And I had a very, very big spiral of burnout down years ago and it was awful. So the signs are there, but what happens with burnout is we ignore them. It's sort of when, I don't know if you did this when you were a teenager, but when the check engine light on your car comes on and you put a piece of tape over it so you don't have to look at it. If you take the tape off the light will tell you, hey, it's we have to take a look under the hood. The check engine light for humans, that's going to be things like eating and sleeping. Are you doing either? Right now, if you're coasting on 2 hours of sleep and 3 pots of coffee, it's not hard to look at that and go, that's going to lead to burnout. But we have to be willing to listen to the check engine lights or look at them and then ask ourselves periodically, how am I doing? No, how am I really doing? Because things like resentment, that's a little check engine light. Anxiety is a check engine light. You know, people talk about anxiety like it's a something horrible that shouldn't be happening, but life is tough sometimes. Anxiety is there to warn us when there's a problem. If you cannot function without shaking and feeling like you're about to panic all of the time, we're going to call that a sign from your brain's dashboard that it's time to take that car in for some servicing.
And taking the car in for servicing, what does someone do? So they're at that point, they see the warning lights, but they still have the same amount of work, the same emails coming in, all of that. What's the next best step at somebody that is in that position?
That's where I really like the question, what are my choices? Because sometimes you don't have a lot of them, but it's very rare that we have none. And that's where trauma comes in. You know, a definition of trauma is the complete absence of choice, because if you could have chosen, you would have chosen not to have the trauma. So even if you, I call these micro yeses, even if your only option is to gulp down a protein shake in the 3 minutes that you have in your car in between meetings, we're going to do that. We're going to clock that as a win, and we're going to give you credit for it. We're very, very quick as humans to discredit and discount and minimize our little wins. But those little micro yeses create micro shots of dopamine. And then eventually those compound and build momentum. And anyone who's ever thought to themselves, I don't know what my problem is. Once I get to the gym, I'm fine. It's the getting there that's the problem. Micro yeses and celebrating micro wins solves for the starting gate problem. Once momentum kicks in, the principle of momentum means, okay, an object in motion is going to be able to stay in motion, but we've got to get that ball up and running. Micro yeses get that job done.
Micro yeses, everybody. Stay with us. And when we come back, we are going to hear from Britt Frank about where you can find her, all about her books, which are amazing. I own two of them. And you can learn so much from Britt. It's amazing the amount of research and time she has put into these things. And I mean, forget that. Beyond that is just, she is a very kind, grounded, and ever-learning, ever-growing human being, and I just appreciate that about her so much. So stay with us so you can find out all about where to find her.
We'll be right back with more insight, inspiration, and real conversations. This is Spanish Janice on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm Janice Burt, and you're watching Spanish Janice. Let's keep growing together.
Bienvenidos, amigos, to Spanish Janice. You like that? I have to put in a little bit of Spanish in here since it is Spanish Janice. We are wrapping up this fantastic episode with Britt Frank. And before we talk any more about getting unstuck, about living our best, most vibrant lives, Britt, tell us where we can find you. I also want you to tell us about all the books and the books to come. Take it away.
Oh, I would love to stay connected. I don't have a social media team. It's all me. So if you find me on Instagram at Britt Frank and you DM me, it will be me answering you. And I try to answer everybody. You can find me on LinkedIn and all of those places, or my website is BrittFrank.com.
And so I have The Science of Stuck, which is, I'm not sure when you wrote that book, but tell us a little bit about each of the books you've written and what we can find, what questions they answer for us.
So The Science of Stuck, I wrote during COVID. I actually got the book deal on my wedding day. And then very shortly after that, the world shut down. And I had time and space to write that book. And so I did. And then it came out in March of 22. And that book really was the one I wished I had had early on, because there's a time where there's so many books and so many podcasts, and where do you start and what do you do? And I couldn't find anything where someone said, hey, listen, I've read a bunch of stuff. Here's my field guide. It's like a restaurant guide to self-help and wellness and neuroscience. Here's everything I think you need to know that's just the bottom line. What's the bottom line with anxiety, with boundaries, with self-care, with all of these things, with family dynamics? And so The Science of Stuck is sort of my love letter, my show and tell of what I think are all of the best bottom line things that humans probably need to know that we probably should have been taught from early on. And then I've snuck a few of my own theories and frameworks in there because I could. So that was that one. And then I wrote a workbook called the Getting Unstuck Workbook. And that's for people who don't want to read anything. They just want the exercises. Kind of like online when you want a recipe. And the blogger is like, and then we grew the sun-ripened raspberries. I'm like, how much sugar do I need? And so the workbook is just nuts and bolts, tactical, here are the exercises. And then my third book is called Align Your Mind. And that one is less about the brain and the body and more about those parts of ourselves, like the inner critic and the self-saboteur and the inner child and these things that we all intuitively feel, right? We all have the thought, part of me knows that I should eat vegetables, but there's this other part of me that's door-dashing donuts. Is that just me? Can't just be me. And so what are these parts of us? And then how do we make friends with our own minds? Because if you want to talk regulation in an uncertain world, the greatest gift that we can give other people is feeling at home in our own minds. Because people who are friends with themselves tend not to act in ways that are intentionally harmful. And then my new book is called Shame Spiral. We'll have to do this again. And that'll be out next fall. And I'm writing that now.
Oh my goodness. I mean, talk about such good content and inspiration, you know, to make you really want to align the mind, to get unstuck, to live just this life that you don't have any regrets when you're older going, I wish I coulda, I wish I should've, do all that. So I cannot recommend these books high enough to everybody, because I don't know if you feel this way, Britt, but I feel like if each of us worked on ourselves and just did the inner work of knowing ourselves, knowing those parts of ourselves, knowing how to regulate, just that the world would be a more peaceful place. Do you feel that way?
You know, I do. And it's not at the expense of we should all lend a hand where we can, because I do think there's a place for giving back and participating in the community. But I agree. I don't, and there's this idea that all of this self-work and inner work are going to lead to all of us being selfish and self-focused. But I've actually experienced the opposite. Since doing a personal growth journey and examining my own biases, my own mind, my own thoughts, and sort of decluttering my mental closets, I've become a lot kinder and a lot less hot messy than I used to be. And things are a lot less chaotic. And so the more I understand me and make choices that align with my values, the more I'm going to be able to show up as the version of myself that I want to, and not the triggered version or the younger version or the sullen teenager version. I have them all and they're all great, but whether or not you lead other people, we all wake up, go through our day, and go to sleep as the leader of our own minds. And the more that we can do that with compassion, with head, and with heart, the better our lives are going to be, and the better the lives of the people around us are going to be too.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's the full cup analogy. You know, we can give more when our cup is full and overflowing. Whereas if it's empty, and that was me as a people pleaser, you know, like validate me. I need external validation to feel like I'm enough. So I'm gonna act like I'm doing all these nice things for you. But meanwhile, it was really for me. And kind of needing to fill my own cup up has drastically improved my life as well. Now, what do you say to the person who is like, you know what, if I can't do this thing perfectly, then I'm not going to do it at all?
I call that shame-splaining, and that's a concept I'm writing about in my new book. Like, if I can't do it, I don't want to do it at all. And if something goes wrong, it's because I'm a terrible person. And my question is, okay, well, what behavior does your explanation give you a hall pass from doing? Because if I can't do it perfectly, I don't have to try. That sounds like a great excuse to not do the small things that you can do. And that sounds like a really great reason to just sort of pass along the task of doing. Because whatever it is that we want to do, be, or have, change doesn't happen by absorbing information. Change happens by taking action. And so just tell yourself, what's the story you're telling yourself, the shamey story? And then what behavior is it letting you get away with not doing? Because whatever the thing is you're not doing, that's your path to getting the thing you want.
Whatever the thing is that you're not doing is the path to getting what you want. That's so good. Like if we can actually absorb that and go, okay, what is the thing? It's almost like when I think about fear and how as I've walked through each fear in my life, like my best experiences have been on the other side of that fear. To wrap this up, what is one thing that you would tell someone who really just feels stuck in the sense of, I just feel like I can't. Like I just can't take that next step. I feel so paralyzed and trapped. What would you say to that person?
So, I would say you're not alone. You're in very good company. There are millions of humans running around, myself included, with the same dilemma. So, you're not lazy, you're not crazy, and you're not broken. And then I would say, what are you willing to say yes to today? I hear you. You make sense. Your feelings track. What are you willing to say yes to? Because we only need to get one microscopic sized yes to then interrupt that entire narrative. I can't. Well, you just did. So if you can do that, you can do something else. And then you can do something else. So it all boils down to of the choices you have, and you might not like them. There's a difference between I don't like my choices and I don't have any choices. What are you willing to say yes to? If you're not willing to go do a workout, are you willing to literally put on one sneaker and call that good? Well, that's not going to get me anywhere. It'll get you where you want to go a lot faster than this cycle of shame and belief that you can't. So we've got to find out what can you say yes to today, no matter how small. That changes everything.
What is the smallest? Like, what is the small? I know you mentioned putting on one shoe. What's the microest yes that you have seen someone do?
For me, it was, I think I told you this story at some point offline, when I was addicted to crystal meth and I finally admitted that I had this huge problem and I had been lying to everybody and I called a friend and because I was still forward facing functional. I was working as an advertising executive. I was not a non-functioning meth addict, but that's a whole nother story. Point being, when I called my friend, I was so obsessed with my big problem, and it was a big problem, that it didn't occur to me to find something simple. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm an addict and I'm a liar and I have all this trauma and blah, 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 blah. And she said, Britt, when was the last time you ate food? That question stopped me in my tracks. And I was like, food? And she's like, yeah, you know, that stuff that we need to live as humans. And when you smoke meth, you don't eat. So I was a little chemically psychotic. This woman sat with me on the phone for an hour talking me through eating a yogurt spoonful by spoonful. My fridge had like a can of Mountain Dew, a bunch of moldy food, and one blueberry Yoplait in there. And she just sat with me on the phone, one spoon of yogurt at a time. That's a micro yes. But I got from that bathroom to this podcast with that tiny little step. You know, all you have to do is say yes. You don't know where it's going to lead, but I promise you it'll be somewhere better than if you don't do it at all.
Oh, I mean, come on, you guys. There is no better way to end the show than with that encouragement. The sky's the limit, but you don't have to do this huge leap. You can start with eating the yogurt. That is so brilliantly said. Britt Frank, thank you so much for joining me today. Everybody out there who is listening, be encouraged. Know that you are not alone. And know that you just have to take one baby, like the tiniest baby step, toward a better you. Be well, my friends. Mis amigos. We'll see you next time.